Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. On this, the 77th anniversary of the D-Day landings, our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll is now at 597,000 as cases of the Delta variant of the virus increase in the United Kingdom, and two key European deadlines loom. Prime Minister Boris Johnson is under pressure to reopen the country on June 21st, and EU officials prepare to meet on June 15 to determine whether to reopen the bloc to travel, something that is actually likely to happen on July 1 if they make the positive decision as widely expected. Investors have been scrutinizing the Biden administration's first defense budget request to Congress as commercial air travel, at least in the United States, has had a banner week. And Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun warns of supply chain challenges and a bumpy future with China. Russia is threatening to stop doing dollar-based trade, claiming America is trying to destroy his country and dismissing as hilarious Russian hacking of U.S. networks, something that U.S. intelligence, as well as industry, has said is beyond dispute. And what appears to be a spectacular unraveling of the British Army's Ajax armored vehicle program being developed by General Dynamics. Joining us to discuss that and more, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Teal Group Consultancy here in sunny and cicada-filled Washington, D.C. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
It's sunny, but not cicada-filled London, but it's lovely, and it's great to be with you, Vago. Thank you.
Great to be on the program, as always, Vago, and thanks for the walk yesterday with the many enjoyable chirping cicadas.
It was lovely, and you and I were trying to avoid not to step on the little buggers. I mean, you figure after 17 years in the ground, they come out, they're enjoying sunshine, they just want to reproduce, so they end up back in the ground, so you want to try to be as careful as you can be. And Sash, I know you're an avid bird watcher, and it's a shame that you're not here to actually experience this, because you can actually do some remarkable cicada watching. There are different variants and different stages of development. So I think that might have been something interesting, at least. Anyway,
it sounds like a wonder of nature, even if it makes walking slightly more precarious.
Yes. And they're also, they apparently don't see very well, and they bang into your head sometimes as you're flying around, which is attention getting. Anyway, before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. Ron, talk to us a little bit about the broader market and how it's received the administration's $715 billion budget request. Obviously, when we spoke, was on Memorial Day, and the budget had only been rolled out on the preceding Friday, so not exactly the busiest time for investors to be focused on it from sort of 5 p.m. on Friday to Monday. What's the reaction been, right? I mean, some companies actually had a pretty much of a banner time. Northrop Grumman, you know, there were concerns about whether the ground-based strategic deterrent and the B-21 would survive. They both did. And, you know, a number of other important priorities have gone through for a number of companies, F-35 remaining pretty strong. How did the market respond last week? You know, Boeing having a little bit of a tougher week with F-18 and a couple of other things.
Yeah. So if you look at, where the S&P ended the week, the S&P was up about, you know, 0.5% on the week. And just if you use Lockheed and Northrop as just the benchmarks for defense, Northrop ended the week up just under 3.5%, and Lockheed was up about 3%. So Lockheed and Northrop both outperformed the broader market meaningfully. So I think, you know, that's, you know, the market saying, okay, yeah, budget's all right, right? And that's, you know, and then if you look at Boeing was up about 1% on the week, and other aerospace names were in line with the market or up a smidge. So defense broadly outperformed on the week, and I think that's, so the market liked it, right? And just to remind folks, if you go back to, you know, the end of last year, early this year, and then I would imagine it'd be the same for Sash, I couldn't pay an investor and client to talk to me about defense stocks. I mean, there was no interest in it. The focus was intensely on commercial aero and reopening. But investor interest has broadened, and I think the budget's just supporting that. And defense stocks got to on a relative valuation, very, very, very inexpensive, to kind of a generational low. And they've bounced off of that, but they're still relative to the market inexpensive. And those that thought the budget was going to be, and there was a real fear in the market that the Biden administration would take a bigger hatchet to the budget, and maybe the Biden administration would be softer on China. But as it turns out, as we all know, you can't be a hawk on China and a dove on defense. It just doesn't work. And the programs that supported that position, projecting power over long distances through the Navy, through space, through the Air Force, fared well. And you're seeing that reflected in the equities this week.
And should point out, right, the president put more Chinese companies on the verboten list, not taking anybody off that list, listed obviously President Trump, to penalize Chinese industries that were seen as either predatory in the U.S. market or supporting somehow the People's Liberation Army. Let me just ask you, right? I mean, Boeing had a tough week with F-18 canceled. No more P-8 airplanes. The MH-139, I should note, that's a program in partnership with Leonardo, our sponsor, was slowed as well. Are you guys, and just very quickly, going to everybody, is the consensus view that Congress comes in and makes those programs whole? So even, right, they're all on the unfunded priorities lists that I guess if you add it up, it's about $15 to nearly $20 billion if you add all the services together. Is that still a market expectation that Congress is going to put a lot of those programs back into the budget?
Yeah, let me jump in on that. I mean, I think the odds of having no F-18s this year is zero, right? I mean, of course they're going to put some back. So I think the market is thinking that there'll be plus ups kind of across the board on many of these things. But the market is also cognizant of the fact that you're going into the process from this point, you're at a position of weakness, right? Going into the process. If you're supported by the administration's request, that's obviously a better, stronger position to be in than if you're not. But I do believe that the market is discounting some level of plus ups for those programs. But like you highlighted, interestingly enough, if you were to think about the large companies, the one that fared the best through the process was Northrop, and the one that arguably fared the worst through the process was Boeing, because a number of their programs were cut back.
And obviously something that's really problematic, especially since the company is looking at defense to sort of underwrite and ameliorate some of its commercial challenges. Richard, do you want to briefly opine on this before we move to broader commercial issues in terms of your expectation? Because I think you last week also expected that Congress was going to come in, rectify, bail out, whatever adjective you want to use.
Yeah, I think the recurring theme about this budget, and I don't know whether it's intentional or not intentional, but it kind of sets us up for a real record here in terms of total procurement and everything, because they funded things that typically don't get plus upped, like RDT&E, at the expense of stuff that almost always does get plus up, like legacy fleets or procurement of politically popular new aircraft built in, say, St. Louis or something. So with the stuff that doesn't get plus up secure, and then you're going to have, however many, a dozen here, a dozen there, additional things added, plus Congress will step in to prevent retirements of legacy fleets, particularly A-10, probably J-STARS, whatever else. You've got a recipe for quite a lot of cash being added to an already pretty big budget. So I agree completely with Ron. Defense might be a bit underrated here.
Sash, let's go to the commercial universe, although you're going to get a bite at the British defense apple in a little bit. COVID cases are on the rise in the UK, worryingly so. There are deadlines of the 15th for the EU, but then obviously for Prime Minister Johnson on the 21st, he's under a lot of pressure to reopen the country. Where are we going? Give us a snapshot on where we are on the travel picture. There are enormous number of Americans, including many, all of the Americans on this call, who want to try to get to Europe at some point this summer for work, but as well as for pleasure, and are sort of a bit on tenterhooks. In terms of who's doing what, right? Some countries are opening, others are not. Give us a sense. Give us a snapshot. Where are we?
Look, my first piece of advice to the three of you, but also to any of our listeners, is don't book a non-refundable ticket, because governments change their mind, and they change their mind on the hoof, frankly, every single day, because the data that is coming out is very, very confused. And it's certainly, you know, it's certainly not a linear improvement. So, you know, to think about the, you know, a couple of the issues you referred to. The UK has a plan. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said he had hoped or has hoped or hopes that the UK could open up. Although remember, he's talking about it in a domestic sense, not in a an international travel sense. But he's talking about a removal of all internal restrictions, you know, wearing masks in offices and shops and so forth, being the biggest, but also just the number of people who can meet together. Can you go to a pub? Can you go to restaurants? So forth? He has been looking for that to happen on June the 21st. And the data in the last few days suggests that that is a very, very, very unlikely situation. It will almost certainly get pushed out by a couple of weeks. And what was very interesting in terms of international travel, and remember, for in Europe, almost all air travel is international of some sort. In terms of international travel, the UK actually went backwards this week. We had a wonderful list of 12 green list countries that you could fly to if you wanted to go to the Falkland Islands, South Georgia, Gibraltar. I mean, a lot of British dependencies with very, very little tourist traffic. But the most important one in terms of British tourism was Portugal. Portugal benefited a lot in the last month from UK tourists. Portugal got put on the yellow list, although the amber list this week, which really puts the brakes on things. And now airlines are effectively evacuating British tourists from there before the restrictions restart again in a couple of days' time. So, you know, the recovery from the pandemic is simply not linear. And stuff can go backwards as well as forwards, and seems to be at the moment. So will Europe open up? Different European countries are trying. Different European countries are, you know, coming up with different rules for, you know, the levels of quarantine or the documentation in terms of your vaccination that they want. And I think the big challenge for the EU will actually be to absorb all of that and come up with a policy that has any chance of working. Otherwise, I think there will be, you know, you'll see some of the southern European countries, which are very, very tourism dependent, just saying to hell with it, we will open up and it's the EU's problem. It, and, you know, Schengen area, who cares about it? And then there'll be a lot of very cross people in Brussels. You know, that might make for quite an amusing summer of itself. But, you know, if you look at the broader data, this week was a pretty good week. European flights are up, admittedly, from a, you know, a very low level. But, hey, we'll take that. The US is by far the strongest market globally at the moment. International travel still very weak. But it's, you know, the fact that Europe is starting to recover is a real positive for European airlines that have been absolutely on their back in the last, you know, 9 to 12 months or so.
Richard, as Sash said, travel strong in the United States. I think we're almost back to where we were pre-pandemic with the Memorial Day surge. That was terrific. But the unfortunate part of this is just like people can't really get a good bead on driving, it appears that they've also completely forgotten what it's like or what your obligations are to fly, flight attendants being assaulted, you know, flight attendants having to zip tie passengers, flights diverting. And it was such that there are a few friends of mine who have actually been getting back to travel from an industry standpoint, who actually said it's a little bit of a turnoff and that they're considering changing their traveling less, in part because the travel experience itself has gotten so onerous. I mean, in fact, there are two major airlines that are suspending drink service. In part because it has been such a controversial issue. One flight attendant obviously losing a few teeth when she went up to a passenger and said, hey, can you put your tray table up? We're getting ready to land. And what she got was a knuckle sandwich, almost, you know, sort of buying into the trope of the ugly American, unfortunately. Where are we going from a travel perspective at the end of the day? All right. I mean, you're pretty bullish on your expectations, but, you know, how long before we recover in a way that people don't look at these incidents and go, you know what, I'm just going to stay off airplanes for a little while longer because this is just crazy?
You know, it, of course, it's barbaric and terrible. I haven't seen it. My flights I've taken so far, everyone's been pretty civilized. I think the important thing is the FAA maintains its policy, which has been well stated, and the airlines maintain their policy of zero tolerance. You lose travel privileges if you act like this. And I think this will sort itself out pretty quick. People will get back to things. You know, part of it is, you know, just that one-off shock. And it wasn't all that different. You remember back in the, gosh, I guess it was 92, a bit of a recovery, and you had some cheap airfares, and you had legendary stories of, you know, people asking to open the windows and stuff. Lots of people coming back or just never having traveled or whatever else. We got through it. Not a big deal. It'll happen again. It's as long as they maintain a zero tolerance policy, we'll get through it just fine. Believe it or not, everything, no matter how many horrors there are in the world and India and Brazil, and of course, all the late vaccination programs for a lot of Asia, unfortunately, we're still sticking with it. Late 2022, return to the 2019 travel peak. So staying the course.
Ron, give us your sense on Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun's comments, right? He was talking about strained supply chains, something that we've talked about here, obviously, you know, some questions about whether Airbus is going to be able to meet its ambitious production goals. He talked a little bit, you know, said, I guess, not much to discuss in terms of a new airplane, a lot of reporting on that. We've been discussing it now for a couple of years on this program, and then talked about added tensions and stresses with China. What did you make of his comments?
Yeah, let's maybe start in reverse on that. So on the China comments, I think the way Richard's framed it before, I mean, they're kind of held hostage by the whole process. It's nothing they did. It's just they happen to be an important exporter and China happens to be an important market. And, you know, right now there's a fair amount of tension between the two countries and, you know, everything going on now about the U.S. saying, well, maybe, you know, the virus did come out of the lab in Wuhan, and then the Chinese pointing back and saying, well, no, maybe it came out of Frederick, Maryland. That doesn't help. And then, as you highlighted earlier in the podcast, the list of companies that you can invest in expanding Chinese companies doesn't help any of this, right? So with, you know, the back and forth going on with China, you know, Boeing's just held hostage to that process. And, you know, I think his comments about taking some, you know, caution around that, and that could impact ultimately where production rates go on 73s and 78s is, I think, a reasonable stance to take. You know, it's, you, I get investors asking me all the time, you know, when do you think the Chinese will approve the MAX? It's hard to say, right? I mean, you know, in some sense, we just don't know. And it's honestly maybe hard to see it happening this year, given what's going on, all the back and forth. And if it weren't to happen this year, so if the CAAC doesn't approve the MAX this year, then, you know, Boeing getting to, you know, 31 per month when they want to probably gets pushed out, right? It's a real risk for them. You know, and it's not, you know, how do I frame it? It's nothing they did, and they're just captive to it.
Right.
And then, you know, stepping back on the supply chain, of course, I mean, that's a key thing to keep an eye on. Clearly, you know, we've seen supply chain issues across other industries and other spaces in the industrial world. I think it would be naive to assume that aerospace would be immune from that. So, you know, his comments there are probably well-founded. What I do find kind of maybe more interesting is, you know, not focusing, how can I say it? It doesn't seem like they're in any rush to do no airplane, one. And then two, I think one of the comments that he made this week was they don't see the need to set out this longer term guidance and setting, you know, but I think if you look at one way to interpret it anyway, if you look at Airbus's 2025 targets, you know, if you can frame them aspirational, however you want to. But in the past, Airbus has put out targets and they've generally made them, right? Right. Unless there's been some sort of change at the company. It almost feels like they don't fully recognize the market share loss that they've had. You know, that's one way to interpret it, right? Because if you look at that 75 per month of A320s, and if 15 of those are A321s or 10, pick your number, then it's a little bit of a different thing to look at, right? Because it's a segment where we've talked about many times, Boeing doesn't really effectively compete. So anyway, that's my take.
Sash?
I just wanted to follow up on the point Ron was making about China, actually, and to flag that I think the Chinese have got quite an important statement to make by bringing back the Zhuhai Air Show. You remember that was cancelled from October 2020 for obvious reasons, and they then rescheduled it for the end of September this year. Now, normally Zhuhai is every second year, but so what they've done is they've effectively shifted it 1 year out. I don't think Zhuhai is going to get very many international visitors because I think the quarantine restrictions going into China, whether you go in via Hong Kong or directly into China, are going to be really, really difficult. But I'm hoping I'm wrong on that. But I think they're going to make some pretty punchy statements about the certification internally, domestically, of the C919. And from that, they would expect us to make some deductions about their future demand for Western narrow bodies. And you know they'll be talking to the US and Boeing, or looking at the US and Boeing first and Airbus second. But I think the fact that the Chinese have decided to bring the Zhuhai air show back this year is very, very important indeed. And I don't, you know, I think that we should expect there to be 737 MAX repercussions.
Richard?
Well, much to discuss, you know, just focusing on two things. One, China, you know, I think there are basically three scenarios. One is things get a lot better with some sort of grand deal struck that involves trade, airplane orders, MAX recertification, maybe even some degree of, geopolitical accommodation regarding South China Sea or something like that. Anything that reduces the tension and increases the trade. And the second is things fall apart, like decoupling happens, no recertification, and then Chinese jetliners get reborn as purely indigenous products, whatever else. And then the middle path, which of course is most likely, is we continue to muddle through. And that probably means a slower growth China. You know, basically they accept a state-run economy and at the expense of a market-driven one. It probably means even more state order activity, involvement, you know, basically everything goes Airbus until otherwise known, and those Chinese jets get indigenized too, to avoid having those components that are on the military end user list of the US ever being a risk, effectively a commercial ITAR. They don't want that over their head. So, you know, those are the three scenarios. It's hard to be optimistic about the optimistic scenario. Regarding the Dave Calhoun issue, it's fascinating. Yeah, they don't appear to be in any rush, as my colleagues point out. And then that's not good because it's the only really popular jet out there, the A321neo XLR. And when the floodgates open up in 2023, Airbus is going to gain market share, pure and simple. The interesting thing, of course, with management changes is that the Dave Calhoun there for a couple of years model is gone. He now owns the company. You know, a couple of key possible competitors have been purged. He's got the age waiver. He's there. He owns this problem. So whether he does it now, 2 years from now, even 3, 4, 5 years from now, he's going to be remembered as the guy who either saved or lost the company, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of future product development and ability to compete with Airbus.
Indeed. I mean, the other point I would suggest is, I think that a lot of folks need to pay attention to the fact that this administration has synchronized this budget with the defense budgets that are being produced by its Asian allies, and is working to do that with its European allies. So and try to bring everybody together to more collectively deal with China as well as Russia. And just last week, 16 Chinese jets penetrated Malaysian airspace, Richard. So it's not abundantly clear that the Chinese are, A, going to walk away from an increasingly statist model. We've seen with Xi, pretty much everything is to support the state-owned industries and the state-centered model, and in fact begin to punish the entrepreneurs in the Chinese system that are seeking to innovate. And at the same time, the wolf warrior stuff is just going on, right? So it's not abundantly clear. And at some point, Europe is going to get pulled in. Obviously, China is going to do its best to try to drive a wedge between the United States and its European allies. But I think that European allies are sufficiently concerned about this. The French Navy has been operating in the Pacific and doing freedom of navigation operations. The Queen Elizabeth Battle Group will be in the Pacific, and British warships regularly patrol and do freedom of navigation operations. Indeed, Germany has been doing them as well. So I don't think there's an easy solution here to that. Ron, very quickly, before we go to everybody's favorite topic, which is supersonic aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to bear in mind, too, the Biden administration has also, you know, leveraged human rights, right? And that's something the previous administration didn't, right? So on that front, it's yet another leverage point. The point I was going to bring up, though, however, if you look at you know, maybe future production rates, if you project out and you say to yourself, well, you know, the last peak narrow body production was sort of on a pro forma basis, maybe 1,200 airplanes, right? Yeah, you know, ballpark, 100 a month between Boeing and Airbus, maybe a little bit higher. But about 1,200 airplanes. And if the next peak is maybe 1,500 airplanes, 1,400 airplanes, and Airbus is going to do maybe 75 of those, maybe, and the Chinese in aggregate could maybe account for 100, 150 airplanes in total a year for their domestic market, you have to scratch your head and wonder, like, well, how much is left for Boeing? And in that kind of world, you're at kind of 30% market share. And I'm not saying that's definitely going to happen, but that's a scenario that really could happen. And that should be in the forefront of, I think, everybody's mind, who A, is a supplier to Boeing, and B, anybody who's guiding Boeing.
Quick thoughts before we move to United and United's decision to buy Boom.
Yeah, could I just, I totally agree with Ron's math there. And people tend to forget, of course, that Airbus now has two separate narrowbody families, the A320 family, you know, 320, 321, 321 XLR, and so forth, and then the A220 as well. So they are, you know, making a real inroads into the bottom end of the narrowbody family, sort of 125 seats, plus or minus. Which would historically have been MAX 7. And so, you know, for Airbus to do the two families combined 75 aircraft a month is not a stretch. Airbus's forecasts of or targets are for them to do 90 a month. And they've got good modern aircraft that they can sell to do that. Boeing, you know, has got a single point design. MAX 8, very good. MAX anything else, not so good.
Richard, last thought before we move.
You know,
go ahead. I mean,
it's not just the increasing market share for Airbus's narrow bodies. It's that secular shift away from twin aisles and towards single aisles, right, which means Boeing's strength in twin aisles matters less and less. And that contributes to the high risk of Ron's 30% market share scenario happening.
Speaking of markets, we unfortunately saw Aireon fall apart for lack of funding. Boom Aviation is in the business. And in fact, United Airlines just announced that it would buy 15 of the company's Overture jet, 88 passenger, Mach 2, 60,000 foot, very Concorde-like. In fact, the lines of the airplane are much closer to the Concorde than the Aireon airplane was. If memory serves correctly, Pan American World Airways was one of the airlines that was going to order the Anglo-French Concorde. Eventually was only operated by Air France and British Airways, although Braniff did lease the airplanes and operate them for a little bit there, absurdly in the United States in a subsonic capacity, which was just stupid, but a good advertising and typically Braniff campaign. How does this deal happen? Where is the plane? And, you know, is this going to be something that is a little bit like Pan Am ordering Concorde, something that is historically interesting, but maybe not, right? They're arguing that the economics are such that it would be $5,000 per ticket as opposed to $12,000, which was the equivalent Concorde price, given that you were operating a, you know, four engine afterburning supersonic airplane that did require maintenance. Whoever wants to start this, since you're the big supersonic Richard, why don't you start this?
First of all, on behalf of the aviation industry, welcome tourists, because God knows we've got some tourists here and they've got some interesting ideas about how the aviation industry works. Whoever is in charge of comms for United clearly is a tourist, and however, he sees a good opportunity, and that's cool. But the idea of United announcing an order for a non-plane, playing it up as their future, shows a degree of communication savvy that I'm impressed with, and exactly zero knowledge of how aviation works. Ditto from the jetliner side. You know, I mean, they're giving us costs for tickets. You know, the part of the little quick primer for tourists.
You're talking about the Dogecoin, the whole Dogecoin, and what it's going to be worth in 2030, right? Is that going to be worth $5,000 or exactly nothing? Is that what you're talking about?
And no, by the way, one issue.
And United has also said, and not to interrupt, but United has also said that they're going to do this consistent with their green goals, right?
Yes, because nothing says green like taking hydrocarbons in one form or another and burning them in order to go at Mach 1.7. That sounds perfectly reasonable if you're completely insane. I guess the main thing I would tell the tourists involved here, that in order to determine costs, you need to determine, you know, fuel burn, because, you know, that's really where the bulk of the controllable or understandable costs come from. And that typically is a function of something called an engine, which is the part of the plane that burns the fuel. There are notional plans for Rolls-Royce to do something here, and that's interesting. But the idea of saying, hey, well, there are sufficient technical parameters and knowledge that's coming out of this in order to gauge economics, that is simply, no, this doesn't exist. This is not a thing. Now, I think both sides have really cracked the code here. United gets to look forward-looking, eco-friendly, and most of all, like it actually has a strategy to attract business travelers on international routes. Good for them. That's exactly what they need. And of course, the other side, after watching Aireon die with far more intellectual property and a far better path to getting the plane to market, I imagine there's the fear of God. So doing this announcement, you know, gives them some degree of, I don't know what, maybe there are naive investors out there who say, hey, wow, commercial activity, I think we'll give them money. But the big difference, Vago, between this and Pan Am is that Concorde had a path, a funding path. You could like it or loathe it or whatever else, but the governments involved were going to fund it. This is merely an interesting set of drawings and concepts and maybe even some very preliminary work in search of cash, gobs of cash, way over $10 billion in cash, none of which has materialized. So welcome, tourists. We look forward to hearing more.
Sash and then Ron.
Okay, so 3 points. Firstly, you know, the Boom Overture is incredibly similar to Concorde. It's a bit smaller in passenger capacity, about 30% smaller, but same cruising altitude, same length, pretty much the same speed, near identical range. Interestingly, where it differs is the, you know, the design, if we can call it that, is 60% lighter. I'm sure you can do, you know, modern composites will produce a much better, lighter aircraft. It would be nice to think that it will be significantly simpler than Concorde. Concorde was an engineering wonder and a challenge to everybody that looked after it, and they did it brilliantly. But, you know, to get an aircraft 60% lighter for every other dimension being identical to Concorde, there's some unobtainium being used there. Good luck with that. Funding. I think Richard's estimate of funding is out by a factor of at least two, probably two and a half. Remember, Concorde in 1960s money cost over 2 billion sterling. There was a US government assessment that in 1977 dollars, it cost $5.1 billion to develop. If you inflate that up to today's value, that's $22 billion. That's the cost of producing a 200-foot long, 200,000-pound maximum takeoff weight aircraft. And you know these things tend to cost the same amount per seat, and then you put a huge, great supersonic premium onto it. So, you know, Boom has so far raised $241 million. That's 1% of the amount of money they need to get this thing out. Good luck with that. I wouldn't advise any investor that we talk to that this is going to be a good investment. And, you know, United, I'm scarred by the number of cases where I have had United as a launch customer or as a prestige customer for either business jets. Do you remember Avalar, which ordered 50 Falcons back in the early 2000s and promptly cancelled them again? That was their their sort of version of NetJets. Airbus has got a ton of A350s that probably will ordered by United, probably never going to get delivered. It's not a good airline to have because they changed their mind. And this order has just cost them nothing, but it's given them some great publicity. So yeah, you know, kudos to the PR guys, but this does not make Boom Supersonic work. And then final point, you've got to plant hundreds of millions of trees to make a supersonic jet of this size carbon neutral. Genuinely, it works out about 200 million trees a year to get to, you know, to do what they claim is net zero. And you know, if they got this thing flying by 2030, they've got 10 years to do that, because at that stage the environmental limitations become brutal. I don't think it's got a prayer.
And I should point out to the audience, I made a mistake. It's not a Mach 2, it's a Mach 1.7. Thank you, Richard. And seat difference, Concorde was a 100-seat airplane, and this is an 88-seat airplane. So, you know, although the dimensions are a little bit different, and I think, right, it doesn't have a swiveling nose, right? I mean, so they're trying to take technological complexity out of this, and again, use composites, whereas, you know, the Concorde was at the razor's edge of practical and existing technology, as opposed to the unobtainium that the American SST was made out of, right, which was a Mach 3 program, and we needed titanium and swing wings and all of that. Ron, you're the aeronautical engineer here, and somebody who does think that actually supersonic does potentially have a market future. Right, because passengers, you know, at the end of the day, will anybody who's ever flown Concorde realizes how liberating it is to cross the ocean in 3.5 hours, right? To be honest, and once you do it, you want to just keep doing it. What's your sense on all of this?
Sure. So a couple thoughts. It's early days for Boom, clearly, right? There's a lot of work to do. When you think about determining costs, like Richard said, and ultimately it really does come down to fuel burn. Like Sash said, is it 22 billion? I don't know. I mean, it's a big number, whatever it is. However, the world has changed a lot since Concorde was designed, right? I mean, Concorde was largely designed on slide rules. So in terms of design tools, techniques, that kind of thing, things have moved along. So maybe, you know, you can get a little better economics than they got on Concorde, just because you can do things like computational fluid dynamics and so on and so forth. But be that as it may, it still will cost a lot of money. What I come back to, though, however, and why I take a maybe a little more constructive view on supersonic is, one, if you think about the evolution of commercial aircraft, or even, you know, if you want to throw business jets in that, you know, what's changed over the years? Well, engines got a heck of a lot better, and continue to do so. Avionics got better, right? I mean, situational awareness in the cockpit is improved meaningfully over the last couple of decades. Being, you know, the ability to see through weather in a 3D way, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's pretty remarkable what you can do in a cockpit today. And if you think about the materials used on an aircraft, right? You know, going from, you know, the traditional metallic airplane, maybe going too far on the composite side, but you know, you've got a nice matrix of different materials out there, between, you know, aluminum, lithium, aluminums, composites, all kinds of different things, and even in the engines now, right? You've got, you know, ceramic matrix stuff. Now, the one place that we still really haven't gone, and this takes me back to a presentation that our friend Adam Pilarski did at a conference that you and I, Vaga, were hosting 2 years ago, is the one place where we really haven't changed much is in speed. You know, we're still right. Flying the same speed we have been now for a long time. And, you know, that's, I think that's the last vector, if you will, for change. Is it going to be United and Boom? I'm not sure. You know, maybe, maybe not. We'll see how it goes. But I do believe, that speed is really the last vector. And I do believe that passengers will, in today's day and age, be willing to pay for that speed. If you can get from you know, the New York region, the Boston region, to London or Central Europe much quicker, if you can get to Asia much quicker, I do absolutely fundamentally believe there'll be a premium for that. And, you know, kind of circling back on the Ariane model, I mean, I thought what Ariane was doing was pretty darn spectacular. They just ran into, you know, fundraising issues. But the machine and what they were proposing to do, although not perfect, was I think pretty interesting. So broadly, I believe in supersonic. In this case, are there a lot of challenges? Of course there are. We'll see how it plays out. Ultimately the odds are probably against them, but it's still early days. So we'll see. I mean, that's where I stand on it.
Can I just come in with one additional thought before?
We've got a couple of minutes left, but go ahead. But we got to bring it over the finish line. Go ahead.
Yeah, the one thing that really hits me about Ron's comment is technology. And of course, yes, Adam Pawlarski did make this case. I'm going to actually provide one dissenting view. I think technologically has moved massively against this concept. And the reason is that when you were flying a Concorde, or at the time you were, it would have been flying a Concorde if you weren't in the back of a 747 with the other backpackers like me, you were a prisoner. You had no idea what was going on in the real world. And you got off the phone, you picked up a payphone or something, and hey, what's going on? And now flight is all about connectivity at all times, constantly, to the point where it's probably likely we'll have holographic holograms or whatever along with us on our flights in the future. It's going to be instant connectivity, constant connectivity. It's already like that if you're in the front of the plane, or even if you're in the back of the plane on certain airlines.
As long as it works,
but it's going to work more and more and better and better as satellite constellations get more elaborate.
At the end of the day, I appreciate that. But at the end of the day, you're still on an airplane and on a long flight. If you can cover a vast amount of distance in half the amount of time, that will be compelling to people, and people will be willing to pay a premium for that.
Except for the vast. Remember, these are not Asian machines. They don't have the range. So you're talking about just transatlantic, and that's just a couple hours difference, and you're constantly engaged and productive during that time.
Sash, one word. Ajax, discuss.
Og, horrible. It's my two words. Ajax is the in development British Army tracked armored reconnaissance vehicle being developed by General Dynamics. And there's been a report that was leaked this week, although this follows on from a very, very scathing report by the House of Commons Defense Committee, and also from the National Audit Office, that the program, which has had about $3 billion spent on it so far has 14 vehicles delivered, none of which have got the turret. And this was supposed to be a reconnaissance vehicle. Armored reconnaissance is about fighting for information. You can't fight without a gun. So far what they've delivered effectively is chassis. The report this week, though, is very, very interesting. Well, it's utterly depressing, actually, because it highlights that the vehicle itself doesn't work. The term that I find most chilling is that in trials, it inflicted life-changing injuries on the crew, i.e. it did things to the crew that we normally expect the enemy to do to them. And this is being done by a friendly company that is supposed to be supplying the best equipment for our soldiers. And these are issues associated with vibration and noise. But some crews are getting out of these vehicles and they can't do the job anymore because they've been permanently injured. That's utterly shocking. And there's now a lot of debate about really whether the British Army has invested too much, not just money, it's blown $3 billion of money so far. That's a dreadful reflection on how badly the British Army manages programs. There's just no way out of that, but actually has invested too much emotionally in Ajax. Ajax is looking more and more like the British Army's Nimrod. You'll remember that was the maritime patrol aircraft that pretty similar amount of money was spent on developing, and then it got cancelled when actually a lot of prototypes were flying and left the UK without any maritime patrol capability for nearly a decade. Ajax is a horrible program. It is an exemplar of how not to manage a procurement program, but particularly how not to manage an armored vehicle program. It's one of the most depressing reports that I've ever seen. And it's going to leave the army without a combat capability that it vitally needs. The problem is that certain very senior people in the army are in denial about this stuff.
All good news for the Boxer, ultimately? Is there an adaptation of that vehicle that can be used for this, given that that is a successful acquisition program?
Well, I mean, no, it's surely coincidental, but Rheinmetall delivered 25 Boxers to Australia this week in what they call the combat reconnaissance variant, or combat reconnaissance vehicle, which is an 8x8, heavily armed, almost rather, as we know, with a turret on top with a 35mm cannon. That looks like a drop-in capability to provide armored reconnaissance for the British Army, if that's what's required. But that will require a lot of very senior officers to face up to the fact that they have failed, that their system has failed, and that they have thrown away a huge amount of taxpayers' money.
Richard, 15 seconds on the Australian Apache, the rest of it on whether Russia, this threat by Putin to move away from the dollar is anything to worry about at all, because before we were before we started the program, you basically had a very brief but very funny line about why this is not something worth sleeping. We're losing sleep over. Discuss.
Oh, yeah. First of all, the Apache. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I guess the Australian order, or soon to be order, basically cements its dominance and also just puts a real paw over that Tiger experience, because that Tiger fleet in Australia wasn't all that old and extremely troubled. And you're hearing talk that maybe Germany might just follow. I mean, this was just possibly one of the bigger hellebore failures you're going to find in Europe's defense industry. Now, from the Apache, you know, it's just strength to strength. It's just a remarkable story of a product that's been on the market for almost half a century and has come to dominate it. And thanks for asking about my comment about the Russian dollar move. I'm going to have a real hard time affording any of the luxury Russian products that my family routinely enjoys now that we can't use dollars.
Yeah, you pointed out that there might be something in your gas tank that originated from Russia. I suppose if you're a high-end caviar eater, it might be that, but I'm not even sure, right? Because a lot of there are alternate sources of supply.
Yeah, we switched from a really lovely samovar to a typical stovetop espresso machine. It didn't suffer too badly.
I didn't realize there is a lock on the samovar market. Obviously, titanium and a couple of other raw materials, right? I mean, that is something that that shapes meaningfully our ability to travel on airplanes, for example, and military hardware. And any last comments?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in line with Richard. I mean, to Putin, good luck with it.
Outstanding. Before we go, briefly, Richard, what should we expect from the Speed News Conference next week? You're going to be there. Ron's going to be there. A lot of other smart folks are going to be there. What are some of the messages we're going to hear from the industry? And Sash, you get exactly 10 seconds to tell us what you think GE and Safran are going to announce on the 15th. Go ahead, Richard.
It's going to be fascinating, because this is the first get together for a lot of people in the industry since the last Speed News Conference, which kind of happened in line with the onset of the pandemic, early March of last year. And basically what's going on is just an effort to understand where we're at in terms of the passenger traffic recovery, the supply chain bottlenecks that might emerge as production gets back to a ramp, especially with single aisles, as well as some discussion about how well the industry at multiple tiers of the supply chain weathered this rather terrible experience.
Ron, anything to add as another presenter?
Yeah, I mean, like Richard said, I mean, getting everybody together, it's going to be very interesting to hear everybody's stories, how they got through this, where they are, where the shortages are, what they think about supersonic jets, the whole nine yards.
Great. Well, we look forward to a full review. Sash, you get the last word, 10 seconds.
Yeah, my bad, it's the 14th of June. Safran and GE Aviation are holding a virtual Paris Air Show conference. They're saying that it's talking about the pioneering sustainable aviation together. Well, that's fine. That's green and cuddly and good. But actually, I'm prepared to bet you they're going to have to start talking about a next generation engine to potentially power the next Boeing aircraft, because GE and Safran are way behind Pratt & Whitney in terms of a geared fan. They're even behind Rolls-Royce with the Ultra fan. They need to catch up. If they do that, that will really make it a three-way race. If they don't do that, they may just be out of the next Boeing aircraft. Good luck.
On that note, everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to having you guys back on again next week. In the meantime, hope you all have a great week and look forward to having you back on again. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Bago. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, Fargo.
Great to be here, Fargo. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.